time now is 3 o'clock, and you're listening to a Juno Afternoon on KTOO for Wednesday, November 6th. I'm your host, Lisa Fu. We'll find out about an upcoming fishing vessel conductor training course. We'll get the details about this week's conference of Tlingit Tribes and Clans. Author Kid Johnson will be here with a preview of her time in Juno. We'll learn about Lewy body dementia with guest speaker Dr. Marie Nash. And Ryan Scott from the State Department of Fish and Game will highlight tonight's workshop on sharing Juno's trails. That, Writer's Almanac, music, and more, all on today's Juno Afternoon. First is National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Alaska Federation of Natives announced it will fight the state's petition to the U.S. Supreme Court. This week, the state asked the High Court to review the ruling in State of Alaska versus Sally Jewell, known as the Katie John case. The decision supports federal subsistence management of state-owned waters. Officials with AFN issued a response Tuesday. Newly elected AFN co-chair Tara Sweeney says subsistence defines Alaska Native people, and no one has the right to take that away.
The latest action by the state of Alaska is an assault upon the people of Alaska who depend upon hunting, fishing, and gathering to feed their families.
The organization has been involved in the litigation for more than 18 years. The late Athabascan elder Katie John fought for subsistence rights in the long, complicated legal battle. An appeals court handed down the latest ruling in July. The state is challenging the decision to extend federal control. The leader of an Oklahoma tribe is firing back at allegations from his government. The legislative branch is recommending his removal. As KGOU's Kirk Gortney reports, the dispute remains unsettled.
Osage Nation Principal Chief John Red Eagle has filed a three-page response to a report filed earlier by the Osage Congress's Select Committee of Inquiry. According to the committee's report, there was enough evidence to support allegations against Red Eagle on charges including malfeasance in office, disregard of constitutional duties and oath of office, and abuse of the government process. The panel recommended Red Eagle's removal from office. Red Eagle, who was elected in 2010, says the Congress's action was an overreach in power. He also says one allegation was nothing more than a disagreement between the branches of government. The Osage Nation Congress is scheduled to meet next week to consider a motion to remove Red Eagle as principal chief. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Courtney.
This week, three senators were suspended without pay from Canada's upper chamber of parliament. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, one of them was the former leader of the Aboriginal People's Congress.
Senator Patrick Brazza was told he had to repay nearly $50,000 in housing and living expenses the Senate determined he had claimed inappropriately. Two other senators also faced similar allegations. They, too, were appointed by the Prime Minister. This week, after days of debate, the Senate voted to suspend them. Nothing had been proven, and their suspensions, they claim, were for the perception of wrongdoing. In Brazo's case, auditors reviewing his housing claims couldn't determine whether there was any violation of spending rules, but the Senate's Internal Economy Committee decided otherwise. This week, Brazo addressed the Senate to defend himself. He said he followed the rules as he knew them and did nothing wrong. The end of his speech was addressed to his children.
You are too young to understand what is going on here. I am much older than you, and I barely understand. It is very important that you understand that I am not guilty of what some of these people are accusing me of. I am not a thief, a scammer, a drunken Indian, a drug addict, a failed experiment, or a human tragedy.
Brazo said perhaps he took things too readily at face value or didn't question enough. But he insisted that he didn't take anything that didn't belong to him. The suspension without pay will last for 2 years until the next federal election. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Assembly of First Nations and the Aboriginal Healing Foundation are asking the public to help map sites of former Indian residential schools in Canada by using smartphones and social media. The effort will help in a project to place commemorative markers at the sites. The group say the schools have not been accurately mapped. On November 20th, people are being asked to post photos and information on Facebook at National Commemorative Marker Project. In November 2012, Navajo Army veteran Wilson Halona was honored decades after his military service in World War II. During a ceremony in New Mexico, U.S. Senator Tom Udall presented him 5 medals. In 1944, Halona's battalion defeated German bunkers and was later tasked with guarding Hitler's top generals. Among the honors were the Good Conduct Medal and the World War II Victory Medal. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Lisa Fu. And right now we have Scott Wilwert from the Coast Guard in the studio, and we have Rick Peterson over the phone. Welcome to the both of you.
Hi, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa.
So we're here to talk about the Fishing Vessel Conductor Training Course, and it's being held, organized by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association. You guys are most known as AMSI. Is that correct, Rick?
Correct.
Okay. So tell me, what is this course?
Well, the Emergency Drill Conductor course is a class that helps mariners, and particularly commercial fishermen, but really anybody, helps mariners prepare for some of the most common at-sea emergencies, like onboard fires, man overboard, unintentional flooding, abandoned ship. It also gives mariners practice using safety equipment like life rafts and immersion suits and EPIRBs and VHF radios and man overboard recovery devices. And it also helps crews decide who's going to do what during these emergencies. We'll get together in crews and make it an emergency assignment sheet where everybody's assigned certain tasks. Then the day ends in the harbor on a vessel tied up, and we'll actually practice doing what we planned on our sheets. So we'll put somebody in the water and we'll have to rescue them. We'll have to start a mock fire and put it out and do all the things we need to do to stay alive and that sort of thing. This is a certification course. People who complete at least 16 skills will be able to receive a Coast Guard recognized certification. And this helps meet some Coast Guard regulations that require monthly drills for commercial fishermen.
Okay, so this is a course that's being offered in Juneau.
It is, yeah.
So on November 15th, which is a Friday?
Yep, next Friday.
Next Friday, and it's an all-day course.
Yeah, correct. It's about 10 hours long, from 8 in the morning till 7 at night.
Okay, so Scott, you're one of the teachers.
Correct, yep.
Okay, and I understand that there's an in-water practicum. I think Rick just described part of that. Can you talk about that part of the course?
Sure. You know, sometimes we have the luxury of having a swimming pool at our disposal and doing it in a pool, but, you know, usually that's a little impractical, especially at some of the towns that we go to teach the class. So the in-water practicum that we do here will usually be right in the harbor, in the vicinity of the boat that Rick had made reference to at the end of the day, where we'll get everyone in their immersion suits, get them comfortable, get them in the water, teach them a few things about moving about in the immersion suit, what it does and doesn't do for you, and then we'll inflate a life raft and do some work with entering, boarding a life raft, flipping over an upside-down life raft, and then get everybody out of the water and back to the drills on board the boat.
Wow. Okay, so that really is just hands-on practicing.
That's the feedback we usually get after the class is that it's usually the hands-on, whether it's firefighting, shooting off flares, the in-the-water segment that people find the most valuable. So we try to get as much of that in as we can.
Okay, so this course is called a Fishing Vessel Drill Conductor Course. But who should be taking this? Is it just people who fish?
Rick, are you going to take that?
Sure. Yeah, well, it's certainly suitable for people who fish, and commercial fishermen are required to conduct monthly drills. But it's really suitable for anybody who goes out in the water. There are skills that people that would really be applicable to almost any boat. Nearly any boat has a potential for man overboard or a flooding or a fire emergency. And lots of recreational boats and commercial other boats have EPIRBs and marine radios and recovery devices and that sort of thing.
Okay. And you guys had mentioned that this course meets Coast Guard requirements. So can you explain exactly what requirements those are?
There is a requirement currently for commercial fishermen who fish aboard a U.S. documented vessel. There's a distinction between a documented vessel and a state registered vessel. So if you're on a documented vessel and you fish beyond what we call the boundary line right now, which is soon to be replaced by the 3 mile line, if you're on a boat that goes seaward of that boundary line and you are documented, you have a monthly requirement, as Rick said, to conduct at least 10 monthly drills with your crew. And in order for someone to lead the drills, they have to have been through a Coast Guard certified or approved drill conductor course.
Okay. And so how would people in Juneau meet this requirement if they didn't take this course?
They wouldn't. Really, they would have to go down to Seattle to the North Pacific Fishing Vessel Owners Association course or Fremont Marine. It's not something that pops up or is available online very often. And AMC in Alaska is the only organization, that offers the course. So.
Okay. Rick, for people who aren't necessarily familiar with AMC, what does your association do?
Oh, sure. We're a nonprofit group. It's been around since the middle of the 1980s. And right now we're nationwide, but we've started in Sitka, and we're still headquartered in Sitka. And I'm actually sitting in my office in Sitka talking to you. Our mission is to help reduce death and injury related to cold water environments. So this is one of the classes that we offer. We offer many different kinds of classes, from recreational boating classes to school children programs and educator workshops and shore survival. We teach all over the place. We're teaching from American Samoa to Barrow, the entire West Coast, Gulf of Mexico, from the Florida Keys to Maine. We're all over the place.
Yeah, I was looking at the schedule, and with the name Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, I was surprised that there's a lot of these courses that are happening down south as well.
Yeah, and the reason that is we work with a network of instructors. We only have about 7 to 8 employees, but everybody else in the network is usually a day job. It's people like Neil Nickerson or Scott here who are doing other things most of the time, and once in a while can teach a class for us. So most of our instructors are in port-based communities, along the coastal communities in America. And because of that, we can usually offer a class any place anybody wants one. And we cover our expenses with contracts and grants and memberships, just like the radio, and with course fees sometimes. And this class does have a course fee, but we're, like I said, a nonprofit, and we're just trying to cover our expenses. But we try to keep them pretty cheap with local instructors and with Scott and Neil. We don't have to send somebody in on an airplane and pay for a lodging or per diem. They just drive down the street and teach the class.
Okay, so what is the cost of the program?
This class is going to be $95 for the day, and that's after a scholarship from DCCED in NIOSH. Outside of Alaska, we're charging $175, but this is still subsidized a little bit. We've been offering them for free for years, and we'd love to offer them for free again. But we just came to the end of one of our major funding contracts, and we're waiting for another chance at another contract in the future. So hopefully in the future we might be able to offer them for free again, but for now we have to cover our expenses.
Okay, and it's not too late to register. People can register online, or they can call you to register. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. And our website for registering is amsea.org, AMSEA.org. Or you can call me or anybody here in the office at 747-3287.
Okay, great. So, Scott, so you're in the Coast Guard, but you do teach these classes every so often?
I do, correct. Yeah, I retired from active duty in 2005, but continue to work for the Coast Guard as a civilian employee and most currently as a fishing vessel safety examiner. So when I first became a fishing vessel examiner, part of our qualification process is to attend an AMC or like drill conductor course. And when I went through that, it was AMC, it was here in Juneau. Rick actually taught the class, and it became pretty apparent to me that day that I should probably, ask them about getting into their instructor program and going on to their 6-day marine safety instructor training and then becoming an instructor, which is pretty logical for what I do for a living every other day. So,
okay, so some people are maybe like kind of dragging their feet. They know they should do this, but I don't know, maybe they don't want to get in the water in November.
That usually does it. Actually, people are usually pretty good sports about that. I think they realize that that is the reality and that the water really doesn't care what month it is and who's in it. So No, you know, Juneau's a town where, because of the regulatory requirement and the makeup of our fleet, a lot of our fleet here are on boats that do not meet that regulatory requirement of going out beyond the boundary line. And that, of course, impacts how many people take the course. I mean, a lot of people take the course because it's something they want to do, something they'd like to do, something they think they need to do, and others take it because they have to take it. So Juneau is a town that's kind of mixed that way. Some of the coastal towns like Sitka, you pretty much leave Sitka Harbor and you're beyond that boundary line. So there's a lot more regulatory folks in towns like that than there is in Juneau or Haines. So,
but anyone who goes out in the water, I mean, these are great skills to have.
They're great skills. You know, as a recreational boater, like Rick said, we get into, shore survival, hypothermia, knowing how to react, knowing how to spend that first minute or two you find yourself unintentionally immersed in cold water. These are skills that anyone that lives in this state at some point is going to find themselves needing or wishing that they had.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Scott, for being here. And
sure.
Rick, thanks for calling in. This is the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association putting on the Fishing Vessel Drill Conductor course November 15th, Friday, all day at the UAS Tech Educational Center. You can register online at amsca.org or call 747-3287. Thank you both for being on. Up next, we have Writer's Almanac.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Lisa.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, November 6th, 2013. It was on this day, 1860, Abraham Lincoln was elected President of the United States, a man who'd had only 1 year of formal schooling, no administrative experience. Newspapers called him a third-rate Western lawyer. He became famous in the debates he'd had with Stephen A. Douglas in the Senate race in Illinois in 1858. He lost the election, but he became nationally prominent, and so he was put up as a presidential candidate for the election of 1860, though there were three other men who might have gotten the Republican nomination that year, all of whom were better educated, more experienced. But Lincoln had the upper hand because Illinois was a swing state, and it also helped that the Republican convention was held in Chicago that year. Once he got the nomination, Lincoln lay low, didn't say much until the election, hoping to let the opposition tear itself apart without stirring up too much controversy of his own, and the strategy worked. His main rival for the presidency was his former senatorial rival, Stephen A. Douglas, the Democrat. But the Southern Democrats broke away. They nominated their own candidate, John C. Breckinridge. Lincoln wound up with 40% of the popular vote, but that was enough. He won in the Electoral College. It's the birthday of John Philip Sousa, the March King, born Washington, D.C., 1854. By the time he was 13, he could play violin, piano, flute, cornet, baritone, trombone, and he was a pretty good singer. And at 26, he was leading the Marine Band and starting to write his famous marches, Semper Fidelis, and the Washington Post March, and, of course, the Stars and Stripes, Forever. Though he also wrote nearly a dozen light operas and many, many waltzes, and he wrote three novels. It's the birthday of Harold Ross, born Aspen, Colorado, 1892. Started out as a newspaper man traveling the country, filing stories from California and New Orleans and Panama. He later said of that time of his life, "If I stayed anywhere more than 2 weeks, I thought I was in a rut." Settled in New York after serving in World War I, and it occurred to him that there was no magazine being written for the young, smart, post-war generation, and so he founded The New Yorker in February 1925. He wanted cartoons about real situations, people at bars or in offices or parties or at home with their families, and he wanted talented writers. He hired E.B. White and James Thurber, Janet Flanner, A.J. Liebling, and Joseph Mitchell. Most people he worked with said they never really knew Harold Ross. James Thurber wrote, "You caught only glimpses of Ross, even if you spent a long evening with him. He was always in mid-flight or on the edge of his chair, alighting or about to take off." Here's a poem for today by Kirsten Dierking, entitled Nuthatch. What if a sleek, gray-feathered nuthatch flew from a tree and offered to perch on your left shoulder, accompany you on all your journeys? Nowhere fancy, just the brief, everyday walks from garage to house, from house to mailbox, from the store to your car in the parking lot. The slight pressure of small claws clasping your skin, a flutter of wings every so often at the edge of vision. And what if he never asked you to be anything? Wouldn't that be so much nicer than being alone, so much easier than trying to think of something to say? Nuthatch, a poem by Kirsten Dierking from her collection Tether, published by Spout Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith and produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
That was Writer's Almanac on a Juno afternoon on KTOO. I'm your host, Lisa Fu. And right now we have two very special guests in the studio. We have Nora and Richard Dauenhauers. So thank you very much for being with us today, Nora and Richard. And you two are here to talk about the Conference of Tlingit Tribes and Clans.
Correct.
Which begins tonight at the Jack is the kickoff ceremony. And then it goes tomorrow through Sunday morning at Centennial Hall.
Correct.
Okay, so the conference this year is called Our Language. Can either of you explain that? Why was that chosen?
Well, the every year the conference has, every year that we've had it, has had a theme. And the theme this was chosen, Our Language, in the sense of trying to revitalize Tlingit language as well as Haida Tsimshian. And the featured speaker is Leanne Hinton, who is retired from University of California, Berkeley, and she pioneered the concept of the mentor-apprentice approach to language. As California had, probably hundreds of languages, most of which are extinct, and there are a few that are still struggling where younger people who want to learn their ancestral language partner as an apprentice with a master who is the speaker. And in the extreme case, you just, you know, move in with the person, you know, chop wood, wash dishes, do whatever, but doing it all in the traditional language. So it's pretty much a one-on-one experience where there are not enough speakers to sustain the language. Maybe one speaker left for some languages, or just a few. So I think this is the first time that Leanne has been in Juneau. She's been other places, but a remarkable woman. So she'll be giving the keynote on Thursday morning, and then several sessions that will deal with language.
Okay, so she has started this master apprentice.
Correct.
In California.
Correct, yeah.
And do you know what languages she was basing that on?
Karuk, for one, and possibly Hoopa. I'm not sure, but I know there's several that she's worked with.
And is that something that has been used for the Tlingit language, is this master-apprentice approach?
Yeah, some of our colleagues have tried it in different places, and it's very difficult because you have to just find time to work with another person and stay in the language, and it's difficult for younger people who are working and have jobs, or for elders, or and so on. So it's not an easy thing to pull off. But we've had some of our students basically drop out of school and move in with their grandparents. And
wow.
Say, well, okay, this is good, because you know the school's always going to be there, but grandpa maybe not. And if he's the last speaker of one of the languages like Haida or Tsimshian or Tlingit, it probably makes time to make sense to be with that person as much as you can.
Okay, so I know the two of you are obviously very involved in the conference. Can you tell me in what ways you've been involved?
Well,
I've been involved since 40 years ago. And I discovered Tlingit when I was hired to teach Tlingit. And I discovered that it's a real difficult language to teach. I was hired to teach Tlingit at the high school. And, well, it didn't work out too well. I needed linguistic material, which I found, so I went ahead and started to learn how to read the Tlingit from the books that the linguists prepared.
Yeah, and in this conference, as well as being on the planning committee, Nora is going to be giving a reading at the banquet. We'll also have two other native keynote speakers, Ethel Makinen from Sitka and I believe Joe Hodge from Klukwan. And then Nora will give a short poetry reading, and as writer laureate, she's the first native writer laureate, so we want to show that off at the conference.
Certainly. Yeah. Do you think that since you've been teaching, or that there have been more material developed to teach Tlingit?
Yes. From the Whitecliff Bible translators. They were the women who went to Angoon and worked with the Tlingit elders over there.
Mm-hmm.
And they prepared some reading books, tiny books, and they were very good. I could read them. I was my own judge. I could read them, and I started to learn how to read everything that they prepared. I tried to get a hold of. And that was it.
What's exciting to me is that we're now seeing the linguistic children and grandchildren of the people that Nora is talking about. So they're and the materials have, as you mentioned, have expanded. So one of them is Carrie Edwards' new dictionary of Tlingit, which is really wonderful. And so Carrie would be sort of the linguistic grandchild of Nation story that the ones that Nora is describing, you know, several years ago.
Yeah.
So this conference is bringing speakers and educators and academics from all over the state and from all over the country, too.
Country and
yes.
Some from Canada. And I don't know if we have any from Europe this time around.
There's the woman whose home village is in Spain, was it?
Could be. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But it must be just great to bring all these peers together who are kind of focused on the same thing.
It is. And one of the things that a lot of people have mentioned about the CLAN conference, it's exciting because you have both academics and people in the community, so community scholars. And there's really not any other venue that does that, because it's not like the American Anthropological or the English, you know, where they're strictly academic. But we have the scholars from the community and then learners. It's exciting. And we cover several areas.
Students who are going to this college
sure.
mm-hmm. are very good in Tlingit, learning Tlingit.
Yeah.
So we're just really happy about them.
Yeah,
I forget how many there are.
Well, I don't know about the students, but the registrations, Peter Metcalf, who is sort of our Action Central guy, said he's got 221 registrations as of this afternoon, so there's a wide.
My God.
And you mentioned that we'll have several breakout or parallel sessions. We got so many papers. We have on the average, you know, like three sessions at any session will have, you know, maybe three competing, which sometimes it's hard because if you want to go to language and archaeology and health and whatever, And you mentioned also the materials. We're going to have one session we're calling the Complete Tlingit Library.
I read about that one. That sounds amazing. And there's people who are writing blogs in Tlingit and doing all sorts of things online. And
it's expanded massively from when we started.
And there's even going to be a Tlingit spelling bee?
Yes. Linda Bilardi and Duffy Wright from Huda organized the Tlingit spelling bee. I think it's the first ever, at least.
So there's going to be language, politics, history, anthropology, education.
Mm-hmm.
And it touches from local stuff. I know there's a talk on Juneau's comprehensive plan, regional issues, state issues. And is it too late to register? How can people get involved?
Oh, no, absolutely. We welcome. It's never too late. And you can do it at the door tomorrow morning. Tonight is called the Warming of Hands. It's just sort of a meet and greet thing. And then we start officially tomorrow morning. And if anybody's interested, you can come the whole thing or just for certain activities. I know there's a special session on Chilkat weaving one day that people may want to come to that aren't interested in the other, and vice versa. There'll be books for sale.
So throughout all these great talks, I think they're kind of in hour and a half blocks. There's going to be a weaving demonstration, language immersion. There just seems to be a lot going on. How can people find a schedule?
There is one online, but I can't give you it from my head if you've got it.
Right? I think if you were to just probably Google Conference of Tlingit Tribes and Clans, you can go to the site, and there's a whole program on what's going on, and there's so much going on. I encourage everyone to go online, read it, and you're probably going to find 10 things that you want to go to. I've already found, I think, 15 things, and I haven't even read the whole thing. So is there any other information that you wanted to talk about?
No, I think that's you've covered the highlights there. And other than just to say that this is the sixth time that we've done this, and the idea started in 1993 with Andy Hope, who passed away a couple of years ago. And one of the exciting things is we're going into a whole new generation of organizers, as those of us who've been there in the trenches are kind of tiring out. But Ishmael Hope, who's Andy's son, was one of the main organizers of this. And Peter Metcalf has been there in the trenches, and Steve Henriksen. And so we're happy to see now Lance Twitchell and Ishmael. And, you know, as Kennedy said, the torch is being passed to a new generation of Tlingits. So we're happy to see that happening.
Okay, so that starts tonight is the opening ceremony, but there are programs that start tomorrow morning through Sunday morning at Centennial Hall, and Nora Downhower will be doing a reading, which is very exciting. So I encourage everyone to attend the Conference of Tlingit Tribes and Clans. We're very lucky to have it here in Juneau, and again, starts tonight with programs starting tomorrow morning. Thank you guys both so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
Adu seeks away, ya ye nach yon de yon. Wasayati, we kushit lakha, we kushit lakha. Agwa ge ach seek away, who away, who away. Adu seeks away. Wasayati, we kushit lakha, we kushit lakha, agwa ge ach sik awe, hu awe, hu awe, adu sik sawe, ya yi nach yan de yan, wasayati, wasayati, we kushit lakha.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on KTOO. And right now we have Kiz Johnson and Jonas Lamb in the studio. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi, Lisa.
So I'm very excited to have you both here today. Kiz Johnson, you have written a great collection of stories called At the Mouth of the River of Bees.
Yeah. That came out late last year. And I'm here to talk about it and to read from it for the One Campus, One Book weekend.
Great. Okay. So, Jonas, can you tell us about what is One Campus, One Book?
One Campus, One Book is a common reading program at UAS. Common reading programs are just sort of targeted at mostly at first-year students at university campuses to try to sort of build community for these new students around a shared reading experience. That's where we're at right now. We definitely hope to sort of build toward more of a civic model to include more of the broader Juno community. Chicago has a great program like that. And so that's where we're at with One Campus, One Book right now.
So the idea is that every freshman got this book and they've all read it.
That's the ideal. We provide a copy for everyone that attends new student orientation. So that's about 200 students this fall. And then we have the faculty on the committee that helped select the book. We work with teaching faculty to try to integrate it into the curriculum in as many different classes as we can. So there's about 12 classes that are reading portions or all of the collection this fall.
Okay. So, Kiz, so you just came to Juno?
Yes. Yeah, I just landed this afternoon, actually.
Have you been out to UAS yet?
No, I haven't made it there, but I made it up to the glacier already.
And how was it?
It was wonderful.
Oh, great. We don't need to talk about that.
Yeah.
So your collection, At the Mouth of the River of Bees, there's kind of a mixture of different types of stories, ranges from fiction to science fiction.
Yeah, and fantasy. And mainstream. And I really like writing without necessarily constraining myself. I started out originally writing fantasy and horror and moved away from that, except that sometimes those elements still come into my stuff. So I really write a bunch of different things, and there's a little bit of everything that I've written in that collection.
So this is a collection of stories from between what time to what time? Like, when did you start writing these?
Most of the stories are from the last, say, 7 or 8 years.
Okay.
But the very first stories, the oldest story there, I wrote 2 years after I started writing, and that's actually an Alaska story.
Oh.
So I wrote it in, a few years ago. And it was that thing, it's called wolf trapping because that's what the lower 48 knows about Alaska.
So when did you start writing?
I started writing when I was 25, actually. I'd had other jobs and I'd gotten a history degree. I read a lot, but I started writing when I took a writing class from a continuing ed instructor. And I had taken quilting before that and wasn't a very good quilter. And I'd taken calligraphy before that and I wasn't a very good calligrapher. But I fell in love with the writing and I just never stopped.
Wow, so you really didn't start until you were 25.
I wrote a lot of bad poetry when I was a teenager.
Okay, because I saw that you're also a poet.
Yeah. I hope my poetry isn't all about boys the way it was when I was 14. But yeah, I have written poetry, but mostly in recent years not.
Wow. Okay, so you wanted to do a reading?
No, actually, what I have in my hands is not my reading. It's just my list of the things that we're doing because we're doing a lot of really fun stuff this weekend.
You are doing a lot of fun stuff this weekend. Okay, before we get to that, though, I read a segment of one of your stories about pets going through the change.
Yes, the evolution of trickster stories among the dogs of North Park after the change. Which is probably what I'm going to read on Friday night, actually.
Okay. So can I ask you questions about it?
Yes, you can. No surprise in it.
Well, so can you explain to the audience what is the change?
The story is about the assumption is that all of the animals that people have changed to suit their needs, so cats, dogs, horses, cows, things like that, they all gain the ability to speak and they gain enough sort of self-awareness to be able to have thoughts worth framing. And the story is about what happens when the animals suddenly can communicate with us because we tend not to we tend to treat all animals as animals, so we don't really think about the feelings that cattle have or our horses have or even our dogs, although we're probably closer to dogs than anything else. So that's what it's about, is what happens when our animals are given the ability to speak and we have to hear what they're saying.
Which is, it's a really great story. And
Thank you.
That's what the reading that you're going to do.
Yes.
So when will you be doing that?
Friday, it's 7 o'clock, and it is, I don't remember where. It's the library.
The library.
I knew it was a library.
It'll be part of the Evening at Egan on Friday evening at 7 o'clock in the Egan Library. And Kij will be reading from that story and then also just sort of discussing craft and probably some of the concepts that came into creating mm-hmm. that tale.
Right, absolutely. I'd like to talk a little bit about just sort of the resonances. Animals are such an interesting thing to write about, and the reasons why almost every story in that collection is about animals. So I'll talk a little bit about that, but there's so many topics that are fun to talk about, so there will be questions at the end. I'll try to answer some of other people's questions as well.
Yeah, so for anybody in the listening audience, if that sounds intriguing to you, what would happen if your dog or cat could talk and formulate their thoughts? You should definitely come to this reading. What other events will you be doing while you're in town?
I'm sitting in or talking at a whole bunch of classes tomorrow. Tonight, I'm really excited because the Drama Society is doing versions of four of the shortest short stories, and I cannot wait to see that. And then on Saturday at the public library here, I'm doing a master class in how to write short fiction, probably. And we'll just talk a lot about craft, and it'll be a lot of information in a hurry because there's so much that can be said about that.
And it's a master class.
It's a class for anybody. Master class is just sort of, in this case, it's just me piling a lot of information into a very short period.
Can beginner creative writers
mm-hmm, attend? Absolutely. People who've never written before can do it, although I think it's going to fill pretty fast if it hasn't.
Yeah, last I heard there were a few spaces left. It's Saturday at the Douglas Library from 1 to 4. The public library has information on registration on their website, but I'm sure if you called the public library and asked, they may have a few spaces remaining.
And anybody who's interested in seeing Kij Johnson's schedule, if you go to One Campus, One Book, UAS, if you just Google that, you can see Kij's schedule in Juneau and just find out all the functions she's going to be at. Well, thank you guys both so much for coming in. Again, if you're interested in finding out what happens when dogs and cats can talk, go to UAS Egan Library to hear the reading.
Great.
Thanks, Lisa.
To a Juneau Afternoon on KTOO. I'm your host, Lisa Fu, and right now we have Dr. Maureen Nash in the studio. Welcome, Dr. Nash.
Thank you.
So you are going to be giving a talk tonight at Centennial Hall.
Yes.
On Lewy body dementia. And the title of the talk is, What is Lewy body dementia? I don't think many people know that term, but I think many people know people who have this.
Well, Lewy body dementia is the second most common type of dementia. It's somewhat related to Parkinson's disease. and has a lot of overlap with Alzheimer's type dementia, which is sort of the most common kind of dementia.
Okay, so why are you giving this talk tonight?
Well, I was invited to come up to Alaska to talk on this topic because it is becoming more and more well known as a phrase, but lots of people don't know what it looks like when people have the illness. And there's some very specific medication issues that are helpful to know if you or your loved one have the illness. And so they asked me to come up and just talk about what is Lewy body dementia, what does it look like when somebody has that, how can we help people, what's the research going on in the area.
Okay, so you're going to be talking about symptoms, how to tell if maybe you or your loved one has it?
Yeah, there's sort of typical symptoms, including Parkinsonian-type movements, often visual hallucinations, sometimes some suspiciousness or fearfulness, and then memory impairment that goes along with it. And it can really impact a person's functioning. And so, as with many illnesses, the more one knows, the better able one is able to help people with it.
Okay, and who should be attending? Who should come tonight to this talk?
Well, it's a talk for the general public, although it would be very helpful actually for medical professionals or caregivers or really anybody who works with older adults would probably find something helpful in the discussion.
And what is your experience or your background?
I am an internal medicine physician as well as a psychiatrist. I'm the medical director of a geriatric psychiatry unit in the Portland, Oregon area, and then I'm on the board of directors of the American Association for Geriatric Psychiatry, and I head their clinical practice committee. So I've been working with older adults full-time since 2002.
Okay, and what you had said in the beginning was that this is a pretty common disease.
Yes, 10 to 15% of people who have dementia will have Lewy body dementia. And certainly folks with Parkinson's disease, a certain number of those go on to develop dementia. And that is it's kind of a sibling illness to Lewy body dementia.
Okay, and this disease is named after a scientist.
Yes.
Can you tell me about him?
Well, so Dr. Lewy is a fellow who chopped up brain cells and looked at them under a microscope, and he saw that there was this extra round thing in the nucleus, next to the nucleus in the brain cell. And he said, gee, that's not supposed to be there. And he described it actually in people with Parkinson's disease. Turns out that it's also in some other illnesses like Lewy body dementia. And so, as with many things, you get a disease named after you if you find some terrible, terrible thing. So he's long gone, but we still remember his name.
Okay. So what can you talk about what are some of the symptoms?
Sure. The most common presenting symptom are very vivid visual hallucinations. And so, for instance, they can be very benign things like seeing a cherub or a little angel up in the corner of a bedroom, or they can be seeing someone in your bedroom at night, which would be pretty frightening for most people. And so they can really range from the very benign to the very frightening. But the key thing about them is they're very, very detailed. They often last for minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. And people who have this illness tend to have the same type of hallucination over and over and over for many months or even for years, which is different than many other illnesses where people have hallucinations. You know, it's very varied and it doesn't stay the same.
Okay. And what is the sort of care that someone with Lewy body dementia should?
Well, there are some medications that can help people slow down functional decline. There are some medications that can help treat fearfulness when people have it. There are certain sleep abnormalities. REM sleep behavior disorder often accompanies Lewy body disorder. So working with caregivers to train them on how to work with someone who has the illness, how to relate to them, as well as sort of the general advice that's good for everybody. Exercise, especially early in the day, eat right, and try and get good rest at night.
Okay, great. So we've been speaking with Dr. Maureen Nash, who will be giving a talk tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. at Centennial Hall. It is a free program for the general public. It's great information. We've just been hearing a little bit about Lewy body dementia, but if you want to know a whole lot more, come to tonight's talk. Thank you so much, Dr. Nash.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Listening to a Juno Afternoon on KTOO. I'm your host, Lisa Fu, and right now we have Ryan Scott in the studio. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And you work for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Yes, ma'am.
What do you do there?
I'm the local management biologist, so manage all the game species here in northern southeast.
Okay, and we often hear your name in the news.
Yeah. So during the summertime, a large part of our time is spent with bear things going on in urban bears in communities around northern southeast.
Okay. And so how are the bears still around? Or
There's a few stragglers. Certainly things have dropped off. It's getting quieter. But, you know, we're not quite out of the woods yet. I keep hearing the snow will drive them and send them up to the hill. And I don't know if that's true or not, but it's certainly getting quieter. So.
Okay, so you're actually here to talk about something else.
I am, yeah, amazingly enough.
There is a talk tonight.
Yes.
And it's called Sharing Juno's Trails.
Right.
So what does that mean?
It's actually just a change in words from a statewide program put on by the Alaska Trapping Association called Sharing Alaska's Trails. So what we're going to do tonight is bring together folks from the community, the Department of Fish and Game, local trappers, and representation from the Trapping Association to talk in general about trapping around Juneau. We'll cover trails and what you can and can't do as far as trapping goes on the trails. Probably the best thing we're going to do, though, is have folks take a look at traps and learn what they are. What I found in the past doing this several years ago, folks really didn't have didn't have much information about trapping, not only in Juneau, but anywhere else, and really what a trap was and how they work and how they, you know, they're not such a scary thing. And then we're also going to have time for kind of a hands-on thing where people can learn how to open them and, you know, get pets out if they have to, things like that. So I anticipate it'll be a great time.
Okay, so Juneau has a lot of trails.
We do, yeah. We're trail full, yeah.
And so you're saying that there may be traps on these trails.
Oh, likely there will be. Trapping season will open, by and large, December 1st. And anytime you have a trail, that's access, you know, to the backcountry, if you will. And, you know, it's very unlikely you'll have a trap on the trail, but along the sides of the trail, off the trail. Everybody uses, multiple user groups use trails to go to and from. Trappers are no different, dog walkers, same thing. So most trails around Juneau at some point will have some kind of trapping activity around them. And this is a great way to reach out and let people see, you know, how these things work and also give them some ideas of what to look for to know if there is some trapping going on in the area.
Okay, so you're saying trapping season is starting soon, or has it started?
It has started for wolves locally, but really, even that won't get going full steam for another month or a few weeks anyway. But for some of the smaller fur bear species, which are a prime species for trappers, that opens December 1st.
Okay. And so what are the rules with trapping in terms of how far off the trail you have to do it, or?
Sure. That's a great question. In general, if you look in the Alaska trapping regulations, there's a list of trails around Juneau that you can trap. You have to be 50 yards off the trail, and from there you can start trapping, but you have to use elevated trap sets, meaning they have to be 5 feet above the ground or the snow, and they have a small diameter trap jaw size. Bottom line is, they're a small trap. They're not going to do a lot of damage to anything that gets into them, but it allows the trappers to work a little bit closer to those access points. One of the great things about that is we can get young people out there and get them involved in trapping if they choose, but we don't have to go up a trail and then a mile off the trail to start doing it. You can have the trapping and do it safely, and all the user groups can still use the trail system.
Okay, and are there areas of Juneau that has more trapping than others?
Yeah, there are. Certainly, you know, once you get out the road, past Auk Bay, past Lena, Tea Harbor, some of those areas, a little bit more remote, I guess, in terms of Juneau, if that's remote. But once you get out there, it gets a little bit busier. We do have a fair number of trappers using Douglas Island as well. So it's pretty well distributed, I'd say, the trapping activity. There's not a lot of trappers in Juneau, but, you know, there's a fair number of them. So.
Okay. And so you're going tonight, you and whoever else is there,
mm-hmm.
Will show that if your pet does get stuck in a trap, what to do.
We will, yeah, and we'll cover several different kinds of traps, and we'll have a video from the Alaska Trapper Association, some clips from the Department of Fish and Game website. Then we'll actually go through them and show people how to do it. You know, we'll have the traps there.
Are there many instances of this?
No, it really isn't. Thank goodness. Yeah, it doesn't happen all that often, but you know, gosh, it only takes once, and nobody wants that to happen. Certainly trappers don't, I don't, pet owners don't. So this is, doing something like this is a great opportunity to not only bring all these user groups together, but to give folks some kind of information to where if it does happen, they feel empowered and you'll have some idea of what to do.
Okay, so what are the details of the event? It's tonight.
It is tonight. It's going to start at 7 o'clock. We've slated a couple hours, and I imagine that'll be plenty. It's out at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. The Forest Service is hosting the event. The presentation is put on by the Alaska Trapping Association and the Department of Fish and Game.
And this is an every year event you guys have?
It's not.
Oh.
Yeah. I thought we had done it a couple of years ago, but as I got ready for this, I realized, boy, it's been since 2009 we did it.
Oh, okay.
So it is something that I imagine we may try to do every year, but at least every couple of years, I think it's a good thing to do.
So this is a good refresher.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
And have the traps changed since then?
No. No,
okay.
It'll be the same type of equipment and the methods for opening them and the signs to look for and things like that, that there's trapping activity there has remained the same.
Okay, so basically anybody who uses Juneau's trails, this is good to go
to. It is, yeah. You know, whether or not you've got a dog or you're just out skiing or just walking, whatever it might be, or if you just have a general interest in what's going on out there, I'd encourage folks to come out.
Okay, great. So that was Ryan Scott with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game talking about tonight's workshop, Sharing Juneau's Trails. Starts at 7 p.m. tonight at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center.
Yep.
And KTOO News reporter Casey Kelly will be at tonight's workshop. So tune in to Morning News to hear his report. Thank you so much, Ryan.
Thank you, Lisa.
You've been listening to a Juneau Afternoon on KTOO. I'm Lisa Fu. Tomorrow, Shona Strausser will be hosting. We'll find out about the upcoming activities at the libraries with guest Beth Weigel. Joy Lyon and Elsa Demetska will be here with details about this week's Imagination Library event. We'll hear an audio postcard featuring First Lady Sandy Parnell. Alfreda Nord will be here to highlight Saturday's Sons of Norway Holiday Bazaar, and Nancy Duturney will be here with Arts Up. That, Writer's Almanac, music, and more, all on tomorrow's Juneau Afternoon on KTOO News. This is KTOO Juneau. We rebroadcast on Translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
I want you to hold them account. I want you to burn their fingers and make them pay.
The contractors who designed the health insurance website should feel some pain. That message for HHS Secretary Sebelius.
It's Wednesday, November 6th, and this is All Things Considered.
I'm Melissa Block in Washington.
And I'm Audie Cornish at NPR West in California. Secretary Sebelius came in for more questioning on Capitol Hill today about the botched rollout of the exchanges.
Also, now that recreational pot is legal in Washington State, how does that change things for law enforcement?
And why women farm workers may be especially reluctant to report sexual assault.
For one, they are afraid that they're going to get deported. Number two, word gets around to the other bosses in the valley and the other people that are also doing farm labor work. They'll never work out there again.
Plus, a big-time heist of walnuts.
Now this.